I am Plant Online. This is the commentary.ca. Almost Green is a funny, insightful look at one man's quest to reinvent suburbia. James Glave is its author, and it is his and his family's story. He moved to Bowen Island here in British Columbia with his family, and because he couldn't afford to build a truly greenhouse, he decided to attempt something more modest, an eco-shed. At 260 square feet, it is designed for sustainability. James Glave is a former senior editor at Outside Magazine. He was a news editor at Wired. He's contributed to the New York Times Magazine, Details, Vancouver, Western Living, and the Taai. His website is glave.com, and the website where you can see the Echo Shed, and actually where you can inquire as to rates if you wanted to stay, is echoshed.ca. That's echo-shed.ca. Almost Green, How I Built an Echo Shed, Ditched My SUV, Alienated the In-Laws, and Changed My Life Forever, is published by Greystone and retails for $22. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, James Glave. Good morning, Mr. Glave.
Hey, how are you doing, Joe?
Very well, yourself.
Good, good.
What is a LEED certified house?
Well, LEED is a sort of the predominant green building rating system, and it comes in silver, gold, and platinum, and it's administered by the Canada Green Building Council. So you basically apply to the program, and there's a checklist of points that you have to collect to earn the right to have a LEED certification on your home.
And to build something like that would be quite expensive. Is that correct?
Well, yes and no. You know, that's the one angle that is the hardest to reconcile and that I struggle with the most. I mean, my building was expensive. It was certainly represented a premium of about 30% or 40% at least over what a so-called market building would have cost me. But I'm going to save that money over the lifetime of the building. So whether it's more expensive or not depends on, you know, how you add up the math. It certainly is more expensive at the capital intensive at the front end. But in fact, it'll outlast probably my regular home here. Just because it's built to such high standards of efficiency, and I won't have to, you know, redo the siding, and I won't have to pour energy into it to heat it and light it. So it's a two-edged coin, that question.
So how did this begin? When did this all start for you?
Well, I guess it started when, you know, my wife and I, when we had our house built for us, we purchased basically a spec home, you know, design A, B, or C, and we asked the builder to pour a little slab, foundation slab, in the front yard, because we'd always imagined having a little guest space, a little studio to work in, and a place to put up guests who came to stay overnight, friends and family, and so on. So it sat there, this foundation, for a couple of years, and we just started to look at it, and as our green consciousness kind of evolved in the background, we started to see it as an opportunity to kind of do in a very sort of hopefully more modest or miniature scale a lot of the green things that we'd wanted to do with our home but just weren't able to for a variety of reasons. So the idea just began to gel, and then at some point we decided, you know what, let's just go for it.
Were you always environmentally conscious?
I don't know if I was. I think I was more of a green skeptic for many years. You know, the environmental, I don't even really consider myself an environmentalist today, to be honest. You know, I'd always seen sort of this sort of very confrontational tone come out of the movement that I just didn't know was sort of the right way to go about it, I guess. You know, we can obviously attribute some huge, profound changes in every country to the environmental movements. I know wilderness has been saved and so forth, but it never really felt like a place for me. At some point, it changed. It evolved over about 4 or 5 years ago into what I call the nouveau green movement or the eco-chic movement, where it's not about, you know, living in trees and yelling at people. It's about sexy bamboo and, you know, Cameron Diaz driving a hybrid and so on. So really the kind of the seed of the book was just sort of my interest as a journalist in that transition and starting to peel back the layers of that onion and see what was going on. And that's when I kind of, as I say in the book, I kind of drank the Kool-Aid and decided I wanted to get involved in it myself.
How much did all of this cost?
The studio itself?
Yeah.
Well, it came in at about $90,000 in the end. And that's my home equity. So... yeah, it was more than we expected. The original quotes to just build it as a little, you know, basic decode studio with baseboard heaters and all the standard vinyl windows and so forth would have been about 35 or 40 grand. So So it was close to double, I guess, in the end, what it would have cost just to do it out of the box.
And was that because of crooked contractors, or was this because of just the cost?
You know, a whole bunch of different factors, really. It's hard to sort of translate my experience to every day. You know, I live on an island, and that was a choice, and things are more expensive when you have to ship them to the island. We're also in a market here that's been locked in a construction boom for years in the lead up to the 2010 Olympics. So labor is expensive, materials are expensive and getting more expensive, fuel and transportation associated with getting to an island is more expensive. And the other thing is I couldn't realize any economies of scale. You know, when you do the math on what's the per square footage on that, that calculation only makes sense when you're talking about a house. When you're talking about a 14 by 20 foot building, it just doesn't work. So it's certainly been a learning experience for me, and it's been hard for me to swallow, and I did have to make some compromises all the way along, but I ended up with a building that's sort of a very much a sort of a bleeding edge case study for how we should be and could be doing our building better and differently if we had a different understanding or appreciation of value and the life cycle of costs involved.
So 260 square feet. How is that one room? Is that how many rooms is that?
Well, it's one big room. It's 14 feet by 20 feet, and one corner of it there's a sort of a kitchenette area, a sink and a fridge, basically a coffee bar, and then off in the corner of that there's a 3-quarter bath. So there's a tiled shower room with a dual flush toilet in there.
And is that primarily a guest? I know you're renting it out, but
yeah.
Do you use it as a guest room? Do you write in there?
Yeah, that's my office, and that's where I work and write. And I'm not in there right now, actually, I have to confess. But I'm using it day to day for my writing space. And you know, people say, well, what's green about building something that wasn't there before? But one of the realities is that I have little kids, and it's hard for me to work in my house. I work from home, and you know, if I were commuting to a job downtown, that would certainly have a much bigger footprint. So the fact that I've created a one-room office that allows me all the privacy and quiet and focus that an office downtown normally would, then I've certainly done something green there.
So in terms of the building products that you used,
yeah,
talk to me about some of them. What did you use for insulation?
Well, insulation, the standard solution that meets the code is fiberglass bats, and they're installed, they're stuffed in the stud cavities, and then quickly covered up with drywall, and they're there forever, basically. They're reasonable enough. They certainly have a high content of recycled glass in them, fiberglass. But the problem is that they're not always just installed carefully, and they're squished inside the wall, and they have to be compressed around pipes and wires and things. So you're really not getting the actual performance of the R value, the insulation value that's on the label. And it's super cheap, and again, the homeowner never really gets to see it or have any. There's no approval process for examining whether it's properly done. I went with a system called Isonene, which is a sprayed expanding foam system. And what it's basically the sort of the foam in a can stuff you get from the hardware store or the user to fill in gaps around windows and things, except this version, the scale is a little different. It comes on a truck, and it comes with a guy who suits up in a moon suit with a respirator and an air supply, and he blasts the cavities in between the studs to completely seal the building envelope.
And in terms of like in the summer, what's the climate like in there?
It's very comfortable because of the way we've designed the building. It's sort of designed to absorb heat in the wintertime when the sun is lower in the sky. When the sun is higher in the sky as it is in the summer, there's a giant overhangs shading the windows and the glass. So the south side of the building where I do have all the glass, sun never comes through that, directly shines through that window in the summertime. So and combined with all the insulation up on the roof, above is almost 16 inches of sprayed foam under the steel roof, then really you're not really getting the baking heat of the sun in there. So the building remained very cool and comfortable throughout the season, and also the ventilation system helped with that, providing constantly circulating the air inside.
And then in the wintertime, how do you keep warm?
Well, there's three heating systems. There's an in-floor hydronic heat, so pipes with warm fluid that circulate through the concrete floor. That's the main heating system. There's a small, tiny little hot water tank that keeps that warm. There's a wood stove, which I use whenever I'm in there or will. I haven't even fired it up yet. The building's so new. But that provides carbon neutral heat, and I source the firewood from nearby lots that have been cleared or windfall or what have you. And then the third is, of course, the sun whenever it's available, which admittedly isn't all that often on Bowen Island in the middle of winter. So the sun shines through specialty glass on the south side of the building and warms up that floor, and the heat doesn't have any place to go because there's so much insulation underneath it. So really those are the three systems. They work together, and my order of preference is probably sun, wood stove, and then finally the hydronic electric heat.
What was your wife's role in all this? This was a project for the both of you, or was this just your deal?
Oh, good question. I think it was for the both of us, because my wife really wanted to, you know, she has a lot of family around the States, and she wants them to feel like they have a place to come here and to encourage them to visit. I mean, it would be hard to imagine somebody not wanting to come visit Bowen Island. We have such a beautiful place here. But that was really her sort of, you know, drive in the project. But also she saw that it was something that I was very passionate about, and she wanted to get behind it. So she's been my number one supporter. She's pretty much the wage slave that's paying the mortgage right now. So I'm staying at home with the kids, and I'm writing part time, and so that's kind of how we worked it out. So she's been a number one cheerleader for me and a big supporter, and her energy is focused on the edible garden that we've planted around the building.
And are you able to eat from that throughout the year? Or?
Yeah, well, I don't know. Throughout the year, I have some coal frames that I've built that I'll be growing greens throughout late into the winter, and I'll be starting very early in the new year. So those are made from extra siding material that I had left over from the EcoShed project. So we certainly grow squash, winter squash, and things like that that we'll keep throughout the season.
You mentioned your children. You have two kids?
Yes.
How old are they?
I have a 4-year-old and a 6-year-old.
How do they react to all this? Are they conscious enough that they know what's going on?
Yeah, they are. I mean, they pop up throughout the book here and there, making jokes about, you know, daddy wanting to be nice to the planet and so forth. They're all about sort of, you know, we have this sort of interplay whenever we need to go to the village for something. I say, hey, let's all walk. And they go, no, Dad, let's not help the planet today. We want to just drive. We're tired. And I go, okay, you know. It's all about the give and take, really. But my kids are on board with what I'm doing, and they get this sort of big picture about what's happening and why we're doing the things that we do.
And what do you drive?
Right now I'm driving a little subcompact, a little Honda Fit, and it's sort of like a little Yaris, one of those little runabout zippy cars that you see, and we absolutely love it. We did have an SUV, and that's sort of one of the subplots of the book is me trying to unload my SUV before the market catches up, the headlines catch up with the market and the reality. So we just love it, and, you know, we recently took it on a road trip down to San Francisco, and it was just tons of room for our stuff and for us, and, you know, we just had a wonderful time and just barely sipped any fuel.
So the Lexus, that was a gift from your in-laws, right?
Yes, it was, from my father-in-law. It sort of becomes a character in the book as a symbol of sort of this gift. It was sort of like a hand-me-down vehicle, and it's a very nice vehicle, you know. It's all leather, a nice sound system, but it sort of increasingly grew at odds with our consciousness, and we sort of began to increasingly sort of hide behind its smoke glass windows, and agonized for the longest time about whether we could get rid of it, really, without offending the good graces of my wife's dad. And that's another theme of the book, is sort of the emotional entanglements of the carbon-based world, where we all know what we need to do, but it's not always that simple when there's, you know, father-in-laws involved in the decisions.
The blurb in the back of the book from your father-in-law, was that really from him?
No. Well, the book says, what does it say? It says,
I'll read it. It says, Almost Green is a boondoggle from start to finish. Save your money. Go out and get yourself a Costco membership instead.
Well, it's kind of a gag, but kind of true as well. He did at one point call the EcoShed project a boondoggle, and he was only sort of half joking. And he does obsess about Costco. In fact, you know, recently we ordered something, we had it shipped to his house to forward on to us, and he left us this message where he just went on at length about why didn't we get it from Costco, and you guys are crazy, and there's so much money to be saved there. And I guess it's just the truth is we're just not Costco people, and it's I think everybody's parents have their quirks, and you know mine certainly have their obsessions. So the blurb is kind of a half gag, half you know, hard reality of what it is we're grappling with.
Has he stayed in the Echo Shed yet?
He hasn't yet, and we really want him to. He's only been up to visit us once since we built it, and it wasn't quite finished when he came up. So he stayed in a B&B nearby at the time. So I'm hoping the next trip up he'll sort of swallow his pride or forgive us or whatever is required to do to so that we can use it for what it was intended for.
Well, in writing the book, what are you trying to tell us? That are you trying to get us to change our lives? And I guess our reticence is perhaps that it's too costly, that it takes too much effort.
Yeah.
What's your experience for that?
Well, I think we're being told this line that the greener life is easy and breezy and simple and fun. And I just think that that's partly true, but I think it's partly also really complicated and tricky to navigate, and has a lot of social politics and around it and so forth. And I think what we're sort of recognizing is that we're in this in-between time. We're a little bit like teenagers. We know what we need to do, what's good for us, but we don't necessarily want to or can't for a variety of reasons, cost being one of the barriers. I guess there's creative solutions around all of that. I'm a regular guy. I have little kids. My wife has a real job. And yet I decided, I'm just going to make a big bold move and try and put myself out there. And I think the message of the book is really that, try to think beyond or bigger picture than baby steps. Yes, take care of the car pressure and your tires and recycle and all of those obvious things. But when you've done those things, or if you're sort of already predisposed, I would just encourage people to take their life off autopilot for a bit and think, is there some bold thing I could do, some big grand gesture that's a little bit more transformative than just sorting the tins? So I think that's sort of the message I hope people will take away from the book, is a recognition that everybody's situation is different. There's people with money, people without money, people in cities, people in the burbs, that all of us sort of need to find the time or the initiative or the chutzpah to just, revisit our routine, take your life off autopilot, look at where you could be doing something that you didn't recognize or changing something. So,
did you think people like me who are in my mid-20s, your kids as well, do you think we're probably more predisposed towards this thinking than perhaps people of your generation?
Oh, it's absolutely established by research.
Do you see that, do you?
I mean, for sure. I mean, I'm just turning 40, and, all of my friends basically get this, but they don't feel they're in a phase of life where they can really tackle it. And that's sort of, it's a broad overgeneralization, but, I'm in a period of, as I say in the book, constrained income, We have 1.5 salaries coming in and a mortgage and all that, and we have responsibilities. But it's not fair to just say, oh, well, you're just in your 20s and you're just at university or whatever. I need you to take care of changing the world for us. it's kind of, we all have a role to play, and, we all have things that we can do. And yes, it is an established research fact that the traditional non-believer, as it were, who doesn't think that global warming or climate change is something that is human-caused or needs to be dealt with, it's a conservative sort of 46-year-old male, and the statistics will tell you. And, those are the folks that are going to be the last ones that we'll reach if we ever will.
And in renting it out, you rent it out on, how has that worked out? Have people been staying over?
Yes, it's been a very positive experience. I have to say, it's not what we originally planned, but it actually does allow us to open it up to other people and to teach them and to show them how the building works. And, we sort of see it as a sort of a low carbon escape for people from Vancouver who, don't have to get on a jet plane or drive a long distance to really feel like they're getting away. So we're getting overwhelmingly positive experiences, really neat people coming through and who are really keen to sort of have a much more low footprint escape. So it's clicking, I think, with the intended audience on that front.
Well, James, congratulations on this book. I must say it was a wonderfully written book.
Well, thank you, Joe.
And continued good luck with it.
Okay, cheers. Thanks for having me on.
You're very welcome. The book is called Almost Green, How I Built an Echo Shed, Ditched My SUV, Alienated the In-Laws, and Changed My Life Forever. $22 from Greystone Books. Glaive.com is his website, echoshed.ca. That's echo-shed.ca. To look at the room, the shed, and if you wanted to head up to Bowen Island and rent it out, there's instructions on how to do that. For the commentary, I'm Joseph Flanta.